The Mueller report is out. Professor John Grabe is here to discuss the legal implications. This is the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about the law school and apply by visiting law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or hosts and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. So Special Counsel Robert Mueller's 448-page report was released yesterday morning, and oh boy, it's been a fun ride on Twitter and the mainstream media since then. John, you were in fact on New Hampshire Public Radio this morning taking questions from people across the state, and I've posted a link to that, the on-demand version of that show, in the episode description. If you had to summarize the results of the report in just like a quick soundbite, how would you put it?
I guess what I'd say is that the special counsel did not find that President Trump was guilty of a criminal offense. That's very clear with respect to the Russian meddling aspect of the report. With respect to the investigation into obstruction of justice, the special counsel first determined that because department policy does not permit the indictment of a sitting president, that it would be unfair for him to conclude that the president did commit a crime. Doing so would, you know, of course, taint the presidency. And because the president couldn't be indicted or tried, he would not have the speedy trial that the Constitution guarantees to attempt to clear his name.
Is that last bit coming from Barr, or is it coming from Mueller?
That's coming from Mueller.
That's in the Mueller report. Okay.
Yeah, that wouldn't. Attorney General Barr didn't mention any of this.
Okay.
But yeah, so basically the reasoning went as follows. If we were to conclude that he committed a crime, there would be no trial during the pendency of his presidency, and so he wouldn't be able to attempt to clear his name. So we decided that we would make one of two determinations. We either would determine that the evidence was insufficient to make out a case of obstruction of justice, or if the evidence is sufficient, we would just lay that evidence out and refer it to Congress. And then there's some legal analysis that that supports the notion that Congress could find obstruction of justice, even insofar as it involves the president using constitutional power. Like, for example, the president has the power to fire the FBI director.
Right.
A legal question is, if you have the power, is it possible for you to commit a crime while doing something you have the power to do?
Right.
And there's a difference of opinion on that. The special counsel's office concluded that you can obstruct justice even while exercising a power that you lawfully have. And then basically what they did was lay out a bunch of evidence. And I think it reads as though it was intended to be a referral to Congress. Of course, Attorney General Barr stepped in and determined that that evidence was not in fact enough to support a charge of obstruction of justice, and so concluded in the 4-page letter that he made public several weeks ago.
Yeah, and what makes an added level of confusion to the obstruction of justice is the fact there's so many accounts of his staff just not following out orders that basically are a lot of gotchas would have been obstruction of justice charges.
Well, you know, that's interesting. But the fact is, if you tell somebody to go do something that would be an obstruction of justice, my understanding of the crime is that it's complete at that point. An obstruction of justice does not need to be effective for there to be an obstruction of justice. But, you know, using your power to direct a subordinate to do something that would interfere, I mean, at the very least, it would seem to be an attempt. And, you know, attempting a federal crime is also a crime. But obviously it would have been received differently if he'd actually, you know, for example, gone ahead and gotten the special counsel fired.
And I was really surprised by the volume of things we basically already knew that came out in this. There was a lot with regards to the Russians that were indicted. Obviously, they're probably never going to see a court in the U.S. because they're in Russia. And then all the kind of shady things the Trump administration did with regards to Comey and whether they were going to fire him or not fire him and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if one is a close observer of the news, I mean, certainly the report depicts a chaotic presidency, a presidency, you know, rife with internal conflict, and plenty of, you know, palace intrigue and things like that. But, you know, that as you say, that, you know, that evidence, you know, is not a surprise.
Yes.
I don't think to many people who follow the news closely and follow this presidency closely.
The personalities that he tends to keep around himself.
Yeah.
Doesn't help things.
No, I think that's right.
Now, basically, the report also outlines pretty straightforward that Russia did try to influence the election and, in fact, was trying to push for Trump and also Bernie Sanders to a certain extent to get the presidency.
Yeah. I mean, clearly, you know, the Russians made a determination that, you know, that that those candidacies, you know, the success of those candidacies would serve Russia's interests. You know, one of the interesting questions is, does the finding in the special counsel's report with respect to Russia's interference indeed prove that there was no collusion? And there's a couple things to note. The first thing to note is that an acquittal in a criminal case or a decision by a prosecutor not to bring a prosecution because the prosecutor is not convinced that there's sufficient evidence to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. Neither of those things establishes that the conduct didn't happen. Mm. That's the first thing to keep in mind. And the second thing to keep in mind is the report really does lay out not only numerous attempts by Russia to make contacts with the Trump campaign, but also numerous measures taken by members of the Trump campaign to try to benefit from Russia's interference. And it also makes very clear that at no point did the Trump campaign, you know, reach out to the FBI and say we're receiving overtures from a foreign adversary. And so, yes, the report concludes that there was not enough evidence to charge the crime of conspiracy. But collusion, at least in its ordinary meaning, is a much broader word.
And at what level would it become criminal?
Well, it would become criminal if it rose to the level of a conspiracy to commit a crime. You know, and that's what the special counsel said. He did not uncover enough evidence. Although he made clear too that plenty of witnesses lied to him, and you know he cannot discount the possibility that there is other evidence out there that he did not obtain. But, you know, the broader point is that I don't think it's fair to say there's no evidence of collusion in the report. There is plenty of evidence that both Russia and the Trump campaign were seeking a mutual goal, the election of Donald Trump, and that they were interested in benefiting from each other. And I think, you know, just again, in sort of the ordinary everyday meaning of collusion, you know, taking steps to work together to achieve that common goal could be regarded as evidence of collusion, I think, reasonably at least.
So it seems like they made a very, very direct aim to separate the two different parts of what was being investigated. Like there's the part one was outright on the Russian collusion deal. And then the second half was on the obstruction of justice. Do you feel like one might be a little more important for Congress going forward?
You know, the charge actually to the special counsel was to investigate collusion, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, to investigate efforts by Russia to work with members of the Trump campaign to affect the election, and then any matters that arose from that. And that's where, you know, the obstruction of that investigation directly arises from that. I mean, I think that as we look forward, I would like to think that our government is very, very concerned about the fact that Russia did this. I mean, think about this from Russia's perspective. This was success probably beyond their wildest dreams. Why would they not do it again?
Right.
Especially.
They sowed discord. They got the candidate in office they really wanted. They made the candidate they didn't like look really bad in the press.
Yep.
And they got away with it, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. And why wouldn't they do it again? And I think what's concerning to many people is there doesn't seem to be a concerted effort by the executive branch, which is the branch that ought to be leading the efforts to,
the law,
you know,
enforcement,
to counter
part of
this.
The government.
And foreign policy. And you know, there seems to be very, very little interest in getting to the bottom of this, to even acknowledge that it happened, let alone try to put in place measures to prevent it from happening again. And it's worrisome because it's predictable that Russia will try to intervene to help the same political party that it helped in 2016, or that it, you know, it sought to help in 2016. And, you know, there's a natural disincentive for that party to want to block that help because they benefit electorally from it. So I think that that's got to be at the top of, you know, I won't say Congress because I don't think the Senate's that interested in it, but at least the House. I think that's got to be at the top of the House's agenda, is to look into what really happened here, because I can imagine many, many members of the House might not feel terribly confident that this president is interested in taking the measures necessary to protect us in the upcoming election.
Does Congress have any way to force the hand of the president to look deeper into this? Or is it just like we've made a case for it and we hope that the president actually does something about it?
Yeah, I mean, really the only power in their hand is the power of impeachment and removal from office. Yeah. The House has the power of impeachment. You know, the Senate then has to convict, and it has to convict by a 2/3 majority. I think it's very clear that that's unlikely to happen. So really the power would be, and they're obviously struggling with this in the House right now, but the power they have would be to hold hearings, to lay bare the evidence, and to try to bring, you know, the pressure that would come to bear as facts are unveiled and the American people are made aware of what happened and what the intent is. But it's not a very direct lever of power.
Yeah, just from my own observations, I'd imagine the obstruction of justice portion of the report is really going to be popular with especially the younger Democratic part of Congress, because they've been full bore on it, and that's part of the reason why they were pushing when they were getting elected. So it'll be really interesting to see what they do with this report now.
Yeah, I mean, that part of it, I think, is the more is that's why I say the first part is probably the more forward looking item on the agenda. But yeah, I mean, if you are interested in bringing impeachment charges, the obstruction of justice piece is the more straightforward way to do that. Plus, and all this report looked into was, you know, the Russia angle and the obstruction angle. There's all sorts of stuff out there about financial dealings, for example. You know, the emoluments lawsuits. You know, the tax returns. I mean, there's so many other fronts, and I think, you know, I think you're right. I think it's a dilemma for congressional leaders and for House leaders, you know, as they sit here and say, you know, we don't have a lot of time. How does this play out politically? And, you know, how should we be spending our time and resources as we move ahead?
Now, it's looking like Congress will be getting the non-redacted version of it in May, at least is what I'm hearing rumblings of.
Or less redacted.
More likely.
Yeah.
How normal is that?
You know, it's hard to use the word normal or abnormal, really, because it's
normal.
So, yeah, I mean, it's really unprecedented,
right.
You know? I mean, Congress got the whole Starr report. I mean, you know, Monica Lewinsky had to, you know, read in excruciating detail about, you know, some very, very private and embarrassing stuff that was, you know, immediately then passed along to the American public. So this is different than that. You know, it's hard. I don't even know how to use the word normal in connection with these sorts of events, because it's also sui generis. It's so unprecedented.
Special counsels happen every now and then, like you're talking about the Starr report and things like that in the past. And each time these reports come out and they wrap up these investigations, usually there's new rules to get put in place and how they restructure how these special counsels operate.
Right.
Do you have any predictions on how this current, the Mueller report might change how future special counsels act?
Well, it's funny because, you know, a lot of what Attorney General Barr has been able to do, he's been able to do because of changes in the law following the issuance of the Starr report,
right,
which many people thought there were many, you know, excesses and indiscretions that accompanied its promulgation and its release to the public, that there was no need for such broad dissemination of some very, very private facts that were pretty peripheral to the legal issues in the case. And so this was pursuant to a reform effort that gave the Attorney General greater discretion. Of course, it was those regulations were not written with an eye towards a situation where arguably you have an Attorney General who is is not a neutral figure. And I think a lot of people over the last past couple of weeks have become concerned that Attorney General Barr's conduct has shown that he doesn't, you know, that he feels, I mean, what was said yesterday was that he is first and foremost the president's lawyer and not the lawyer of the American people. I understand why people say that. I think some of the ways in which he has handled this have been difficult to reconcile with what's in the report and difficult to reconcile with an institutional actor who would really see himself as separate from the president and obligated to be a dispassionate and neutral voice with respect to this. So, again, now we've seen that of what can happen when assumed structures are actually not in place. So, yes, could there be reform efforts in the future? Perhaps. On the other hand, though, Congress can't even raise the debt ceiling without threatening to bring everything crashing down to the ground. So the idea of Congress ever sort of getting together after this and saying, wow, that was we can't let that happen again. That's hard for me to imagine right now because Congress is so partisan and extremely divided.
And they're not exactly sure if how much further they're going to take all this still. So, I mean, they could say this worked perfect. We got all the information we were hoping. We got enough to move forward with either hurting the president for his reelection or possible impeachment.
Right. And flipping it around the other way, right. The other side could be saying, the way this worked, we were able to minimize the damage. Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty clear that President Trump is going to finish his term.
Oh, yeah.
I also think, having read the Barr report, that at another time and in another place, a presidency that engaged in the conduct that is cataloged in both volumes of this report would not have survived that. So it can be framed either way. I think there are reasons to think that Republicans may not be so upset about the way things have unfolded. And as you say, slowly but surely, Democrats were able to get this, to get the report out. Query, though, if the Democrats hadn't won the House, what might have happened over the last few weeks? I don't know necessarily that the report would have come out in the same way. I don't know. It's really hard to know.
Thanks for listening to the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about us by visiting law.unh.edu or following UNH Law on social media. Be sure to comment and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Spotify. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire.